This recording is of a Maynooth Sociology Society meeting on pro-choice struggles in Ireland, recorded in April 2009. It features three activists who were involved from the early 1980s to the current day in these struggles. This segment is the question and answer session. You'll find the actual talks themselves on indymedia.ie at article 92101. You can download more audio files from www.wsm.ie.
I had a question unless somebody else wants to cut in. Just Sinead, you mentioned the funding and the split in the anti-choice side of things and the split from between youth defence, and I wasn't clear who were represented.
There's two very clear factions in the pro-life movement. Pro-life movement, they actually just call themselves pro-life. They are based in Garden Street and they're a very well funded organisation. They're largely funded by the Catholic Church, I think. Not entirely sure about that. They are people like William Vinci, who is a professor of law in Trinity, very highly wealthy people, big doctors, lawyers, they'd be people who would very much be engaging in kind of high level ethical and legal debate around the issue of abortion. They wouldn't be tremendously active at the moment, they'd be quite reactionary, they'd be out about if something happens. They'll come out and they'll debate the issue with us. The other group are Youth Defence. Youth Defence are curiously well funded. We're not. Do we have any idea from where?
Not that I can comment on, I guess.
They largely consist of one family, the Macmillans. And their style would be quite different. Their style would be quite aggressive. They'd be the people who would be out, I don't know if anyone's seen it, outside the GPO on a Saturday with the abortion fetus pictures. I don't know, did you see the picture that Andrew showed? And the reason I was so confused as to whether or not that was from Steve or later on was that it was the same pictures of large pictures of fetuses that would be very youth defence like. They'd be quite violent. I think they were quite, Andrew probably be able to tell you more about this, but I think they were quite violent during some of the earlier campaigns. So the two movements, they do tend to try and distance themselves from each other quite well. So it's quite a split actually in their life. Camp, and they would debate on quite different issues as well. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, I wasn't sure when you were describing the defence side of things. I wasn't sure, I couldn't quite imagine who the other crowd were, but you're saying that there's a lot of it, it's kind of just independent citizens just actively involving themselves.
I'm liking it to Alliance for Choice.
Yeah, I'd say, I mean, the kind of overall history I gave at the start of it, the dominant anti-choice organisation was SPUC, Society Protecting Unborn Children, and that was kind of Vinci and that crowd, who were kind of quite respectable figures in society. And at that point, there wasn't really any significant street mobilisation on the pro-choice side. So for them, it was a question of holding what they had and basically using the levers of power. You know, a lot of them were still quite respectable figures. They were, using their government contacts, all that sort of stuff, to ensure that things didn't move forward. And when all that started changing at the start of the 90s, and you started to get people on the streets coming out with pro-choice positions, and it was suddenly like, it was also the whole change that was happening in terms of church power in the country at the time. Like, up to that point, if your priest got up and told you what way to vote, 90% of the population would have followed that. Today, that just doesn't work anymore. So, because that change happened, there was a need for the anti-choice people to also have a presence on the streets. That's what the defence came out of. And those two groups essentially competed for the leadership in the early 90s of you know, the anti-choice movements, essentially the new defensive, you won a lot of that at the sort of street level. And that whole shift from being kind of from the violence stuff in the early days to the, you know, they don't really do that anymore, that's because they won that battle, I think, more than anything else. So today, they're the ones that are visible. There's a book, I think Emily O'Reilly wrote it, called Masterminds of the Right, which is quite useful in terms of the other side of the equation, like the people who've had the huge influence in policy making. I mean, one of the things that's worth pointing out that that section did was they started putting people on all the health boards because they realised that one of the ways abortion could be introduced, because it's happened in a lot of other countries, is a doctor could perform a termination and go to the police and invite prosecution. So they, by putting people on the health boards and the medical council, they've created a situation where the doctor would not only face prosecution but could also be struck off medically. So, you know, that end of things, they're less visible, but in a way they're still a lot more powerful, you know, because they know where those levers are, they know what they need to control. If that helps.
Yeah, no, just because I was getting a sense from listening to the descriptions of the anti-choice lobby that it's kind of it's falling off over the last couple of decades, and that maybe there's a feeling that we just need one more push really to bring legislation through. But like you were saying, then there's maybe a shift in focus and power away from the streets and away from a visible presence to more kind of positioning themselves in bureaucracy. Really, does anybody else have a question?
It's not so much a question as something I'd like to just share with the group, if that's okay. First of all, I'm totally pro-choice. I totally believe in the right to choose. One of the problems I would have with abortion rights is it can be taken from a totally female perspective. Now, from my own personal opinion, or my own personal experience rather, this happened in Northern Ireland. My girlfriend got pregnant. We were both unemployed. Abortion was, it was, we talked about it. I wanted to have a child, but she didn't. I was quite happy to accept that it was her choice. So we traveled over to the mainland. We had the abortion happen. But the problem I had with it was that before the abortion and after the abortion, even though we were together as a couple, she was offered free counselling, whereas the father of the terminated child, I was told I had to pay for the counselling. That happened, that was about 2001. I don't know if the laws changed on that, but back then it was, under UK law, the mother of who was having an abortion would be given free counselling by the clinics, but the fathers, if they wanted any type of counselling, were forced to actually have to pay for it. As I said, at the time we were both unemployed, getting the money to go over was hard enough. Getting more money for actual counselling was impossible. So like I say, I have no choice, I believe in the right to choose, but I think if you take it from a totally female perspective, basically are getting the feelings of the fathers, even if they accept the woman's choice. I still feel that, you know, that area of, like it says, UK law, but I still think there needs to be a lot of change, even in countries that allow the right to abort. That's all I've got to say.
Just to follow up, I wonder if they're much known about the situation in terms of travel things from Northern Ireland to the UK, in terms of, you know, is there an activist choice, or is there an equivalent of...
There is, yeah, there's an alliance for choice in Northern Ireland, and that's actually just become very mobilised recently because the 1967 Abortion Act, which is the piece of legislation that introduced abortion in the UK, was up for review last autumn, and a number of MLAs suggested that it might be extended to Northern Ireland. It was a little bit of a historical anachronism, really, that I think that abortion isn't legal in Northern Ireland. It's because Northern Ireland has kind of been blocked a lot from moving direct British rule to more local government when the 1967 Act was brought in and happened to be on its own, and there hasn't been a political will really to extend. All the political parties came out against, was it all of them? All of the major parties came out against the extension, and it's done now. I think it's a done deal, it's not going to happen, but there is quite an active group in Northern Ireland now that are campaigning for that right. And the Northern Ireland abortion rate is quite similar to that in Ireland. What's, I think, very, very interesting is that Northern Irish women have to pay on the NHS, even though their taxes go towards the NHS, and even though they're legally entitled to any other NHS service free, they still have to pay for termination services. So the situation they're in is, it's the same as what's down south.
Attention to this thing about the health. The thing about the health and women and abortion is kind of an area that's very fudged, because the point is that doctors are allowed to treat a woman if she has something like cancer, and if the side effect is losing the child, is the primary aim is to help the mother and not to kill the child. So, I mean, I think it's your questions to the women in the survey, forgive me for saying, seemed to me to be a bit disingenuous. And I'm familiar with another survey that actually, as recently as, I can't give you the name, but I will contact you on the website and verify this for you, that 66% of people would still be, not of the Irish electorate as a whole, would not be in favour of abortion.
I think you're possibly discussing, I think you're possibly talking about the Millward Brown poll that was done by actually the pro-life movement. I think it's 8 or 9 months ago now, and the wording of that poll was quite interesting. It was very motherhood and apple pie. That I would not reverse the X case judgment if it meant that women couldn't have an abortion if they had a serious risk to their life. So the kind of, it was too double negatives. Can't even remember the exact wording, but it was very oddly worded, and more or less to disagree with it. It would be very hard to know if you disagreed with it, whether or not you were saying that I disagree with abortion only being. It was actually quite similar to the wording of the original amendment. So it's very hard to know, would you be agreeing with the statement that I don't think women should be allowed to have an abortion even if their health is seriously at risk, or I don't believe it should be limited to that. So it was actually a very widely criticised poll, and it was obviously carried out by a pro-life organisation, so I would question that very seriously. Actually, one of the very interesting cases that's been brought to the European Court of Human Rights today, I don't know if anyone read the piece in the Irish Times today, on ABC versus Europe. There's three Irish women bringing a case to the European Court of Human Rights at the moment, and one of the women is bringing a case against Ireland on the grounds that by banning abortion, she took the morning after pill twice, which can trigger a massively increased risk of an ectopic pregnancy if it doesn't work. So she was told by doctors that she had very high chances, since she had still become pregnant, that there was very high chances that pregnancy was ectopic. And she is now challenging us as a country that we violated her right to life and to health, because we have said that she can't have an abortion here, even though she could actually very easily die from that ectopic pregnancy. So that's the argument that we would have, that there actually is definitely cases where women's lives can be very seriously at risk. In fact, not just physically, but mentally as well, as implicated by the X judgment.
But have you ever talked about STDs, that women, if a woman
So people don't often think the pregnancy is an illness that, you know, is blocking the woman's health. But like, there's other threats to women's health as well that are often under thought about as different kinds of STDs, which can damage the person's health.
Absolutely, and you'll see that. You'll see that the contraceptives, the campaign for contraceptives, is so likely linked to the Great Britain as well.
Yeah, I was going to make a couple of points. One is that, I mean, if you look at that, condoms, as I mentioned a couple of times, are one of the obvious defensive measures against sexually transmitted diseases. But pretty much universally, the anti-choice side of the equation are also against condoms. And also against sex education, which you'd also imagine would be useful in terms of finding out how you can catch STDs and what measures you can take against them. But the other bigger point I wanted to make is when you have these discussions, we often... there are three different things that intersect. The two most obvious ones are the question of what's good for the individual and what advice you want to give an individual to do. You know, like if you're talking about termination, whether it makes sense in some of these cases or not. And that, you know, I don't think there's any sort of right answer to that that's in any way universal at all. But you can say, oh yes, in all cases, you know, abortion's the right thing, in all cases it's not the right thing. And it's commonly, you know, a common confusion, I think, that's deliberately sowed by the anti-choice side, is that being pro-choice means an advocate of abortion as some sort of universal solution. I don't think that is the case. Certainly the campaign for the last 20 years have been quite keen to also say, look, we're also for looking at the economic issues that enable people to make real choices. You know, a woman who exists in poverty, the choice of actually keeping a child is going to be very difficult because of that situation. And the second thing is the legal situation. Because the way the legal situation works is it doesn't work on that sort of basis of, well, what is the right decision for an individual at all. It tries to say, in absolutely all cases, this is what's going to happen. So you get things like the X case, where it's decided that this 14-year-old become pregnant as a result of rape should have to go through with the pregnancy, should be interned indeed in the country, because that's the way it is, that's absolutely the way it is. And I think the bone of the pro-choice position is saying that sort of thing shouldn't happen. You know, the legal situation we want is one where women can freely make a choice, where there's no kind of court, there's no state saying, no, you have to do it this particular way, you have no other option. And part of that is actually addressing all the other issues in terms of poverty, in terms of social stigma, in terms of all those things. But a lot of those, you look at it, the anti-choice side, they're not active on it at all. You know, I mean, going with political activists in general, I know who turns up at stuff. If you're doing stuff around unemployment, if you're doing stuff around poverty, you don't get the people who are active in anti-choice politics at those things. You do generally get a fair scattering of people who are involved in pro-choice stuff, because we see it as those sort of issues. So, you know, I think those rates need to be separated out to an extent, and it's a bigger picture.
Yeah, I just wanted to, well, first apologise because I have to go to get a train, so but I just wanted to come in on a couple of comments that have been said there. And I suppose they just remind us, I think, and it certainly was the experience on the helpline, and the longer we did it, the more aware we became of just the complexity of human life and the fact that most women, when they face into a crisis pregnancy, I mean, sometimes the crisis isn't the pregnancy, it's the breakdown of the relationship around the pregnancy, it's the letdown, it's the, you know, there's so many other things going on. And the issue of choice sometimes is stripped away from the immediate situation facing the woman. And certainly, I mean, as you were saying in your story there, there are plenty of times when the true meaning of the right to choose means the right to get support to make the alternative choice. And that can be financial support, it can be emotional support, it can be practical support. And I suppose one of the greatest ironies when you look at Irish social policy is that the Irish government's, the context in which the Irish government brought in the first idea of an own parents payment in the very early 1970s was in the context of the British Abortion Bill, where the Irish government, wanting to stop the beginnings of a very significant number of Irish women going to Britain for abortions, they realised that the best way to stop them was to support them in their pregnancies and support them to follow through and continue with the pregnancy. So, I mean, I do think that the right to choose for most people does mean the genuine right to make a full choice, and in the the guy is gone now, but I don't think any feminist would seriously argue against the right for fathers in those situations to get adequate support as well. From a very selfish feminist point of view, the more supported he is, the more support he can offer her as well. But it is very true as well that often it's a choice a couple have to make, and they may not have the same fundamental decisions about it, and they may have to make difficult choices with each other and for each other in that as well. And I mean, that to me is the biggest lesson from them, that is that it's never a happy time for somebody. It's not something anybody gaily skips along to do ever. I think sometimes we forget that in the political and legal debate about it in Ireland, because it's been so polarised and the state has been so unforgiving in how it's gone about it, that we forget maybe the human issues that are at stake for all of us in that. And the bigger issues then that there are around reproductive choices over a woman's whole life as well, and those wider sets of issues about the choice to have children later as well. So I looped that. I'm sorry, I do have to go. I did tell Henry earlier that I had to get out.
Maybe, Sinead, you might be able to give us an idea of what Choice Ireland are up to over the next few months.
You ask a very good question. A very, very good question. Lots of ideas in the pipeline. Probably more action against the reg agencies. We're hoping that our office committee hearing will come up before the summer, and should give us an opportunity to argue our point for legislation, and particularly now that the Western Pregnancy Association has lost its funding under the budget. We feel that's particularly relevant that Western Pregnancy agencies are regulated. We are hoping to bring back the idea of leadership on management outside the GPO just to raise awareness of the issue, get people talking again. And I think that's about it, really.
You have mentioned, I think you were talking earlier about when we were standing around the wine bottles, you were talking about the nature of the changing, I guess, nature of abortion activism around recession time, and how there, with, I guess, changes in society, that it will change the nature of the struggle.
Yeah, there's actually got something that's quite interesting. One of the huge arguments that government has been using, and that a lot of institutions have been using against legislating for abortion in Ireland, is that our abortion figures are dropping. And that's actually because the only statistics that we have are the statistics that the NHS gives us. But because of Sterling the way it is, and because of our wonderful cheap flights to Brussels, Irish women are actually previously travelling to European destinations. A question I'm really asking myself at the moment is, will we start to see our abortion figures start to climb again now that Britain becomes an easier choice economically? The other thing is that as times get harder, we may start to see an increase in... Ireland has been quite lucky in a way. A lot of the European countries that have legalised abortion recently, like Portugal, I was telling you that, I think I said at the end, that unfortunately I felt that it would be a really tragic case that someone would end up in some awful situation that what would trigger change. That is actually what has happened in Mexico, which legalized recently, in Portugal as well, that women were dying. There was stories of women taking a drug called cyclosporine, an ingestion drug, and bleeding to death trying to induce an abortion. We don't have that problem here, because it has historically been so, I don't like to use the word easy, but it has been very possible for women to travel. So essentially, we do have access to abortion. It's unwieldy, it's expensive, it's unnecessarily traumatic because of the extra travel involved, but it's there. Now, as people have less and less money, as there's more and more people in very desperate situations, and now, as we have more and more immigrants in Ireland who are here under the condition that they don't leave, there's when you're applying for asylum or residency in Ireland, you're here once you leave the country. If you're going to have left the country, your application is automatically dismissed, so essentially they're stuck. And in the last 10 years, there's actually been 2 reported cases of women trying to induce abortions on themselves, foreign women who haven't been able to leave the country. So it is worrying that as we have a bigger immigrant community, and also as there's more and more people with less and less money, that we could end up seeing returns back to abortions in Ireland, which is an absolute massive concern. I think the point I was making to you as well, it's one of the things that I think is really interesting about Project Struggles, and that I'm hoping this will continue, is that the debate is very much continuing out there in terms of sites like IndieMedia, blogs. People are communicating about pro-choice issues much more, and it's much easier. It's much easier to find other like-minded people now, and it's much easier to have these conversations. In Ireland, we don't have these conversations with the book. Abortion and politics are two things that we don't tend to talk about. So I do think it is changing in terms of that it's much easier to communicate with people, it's much easier to have these debates. But the face of the campaign, it is changing a huge amount, and with everything that's changing so much around us, it could be quite interesting to see where things go from here.
Sorry. I don't know if this is moving past when I was outside, but if it hasn't, would you say that abortion at the moment, with the economic downturn, the recession, less money, would probably move away from like a purely feminist action into more class related? Because if you're middle class, you've got the money to go over. If you're working class, you're unemployed, you're stuck for the simple reason of money. You know, I'm not saying, you know, it's not a feminist issue, but would you not say the class is going to be a big part of it?
Yeah, I think I did that figure I talked about earlier when the Women and Wage Shift came up in 2002, which came into the height of the Celtic Tiger. We didn't expect anybody to actually come to us looking for an abortion on it, and 300 women did. You know, demonstrates that even at that point it certainly was. And yeah, if that's going to become the driving on bodies and think it's going to become a bigger issue, a bigger part of it, but I don't think that ever went away as such.
Sorry, are there any plans in the private legislature to stop these rural organisations? I am very concerned having four daughters. It's not a choice I want them to be in a position that they want to make either way, that never happens. But I certainly would be devastated if I thought this was the type of practical thing.
There is definitely. We made a submission to the Joint Office Committee on Health and Children to bring in legislation around this area. We're hoping to get a hearing in the next couple of months, so we can kind of feel like the government. In the meantime, we've adopted a lot of similar tactics to win. We went through a phase of hearing back from doors, warning people about these agencies. Our website contains guidelines on how to avoid these agencies. They're usually quite easy to spot once you get in. Because they'll often do things like make sure that you can do it on your own, and they'll show you videos, which free option agencies, or in fact any regulated agency, won't do. So we've just trying to circulate information really to people about how to avoid these agencies as kind of a direct action tactic. And we also do as much media as we possibly can, so that we can publicise once we find out. They change their names very, very frequently. There's one on Dorset Street that I talked about that has had 5 or 6 incarnations in the last 15 years. So we introduce to try and publicise the names that we're working under as much as we possibly can. And we're also going, as I said, the legal avenue to try and find this legislation.
Okay, well, thanks a lot for coming along tonight. Like I said, this event was hosted by the Sociology Society.
This recording is of a Maynooth Sociology Society meeting on pro-choice struggles in Ireland, recorded in April 2009. It features three activists who were involved from the early 1980s to the current day in these struggles. This segment is the question and answer session. You'll find the actual talks themselves on indiemedia.ie at article 92101. You can download more audio files from www.wsm.ie.